From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
The fact of war planning is not secret. The broad designs of what the war is going to be is not secret. What is really going on here is that anyone inside the system, who might have a dissenting view or who might have a different perspective is being methodically excluded.
Code names, deciphering U.S. military plans, programs, and operations in the 9/11 world. We'll speak with military analyst William Arkin about his new book that identifies 3,000 secret code names and reveals the plans and missions they stand for. But first, Iraq is preparing for elections on Sunday. We go to Baghdad to speak with independent journalist Dar Jamal.
Most feel that this violence and chaos that has become the norm in occupied Iraq will only continue to increase after the elections occur.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The military has suffered its deadliest day so far since the Iraq invasion began. On Wednesday, a military helicopter crashed near the Jordanian border, killing 30 Marines and one Navy sailor. Another six soldiers died in combat, bringing the day's total deaths toll to 37. President Bush described Wednesday as a, quote, very discouraging day. The U.S. has now lost over 1,400 soldiers in Iraq. The cause of the helicopter crash is still unknown. It occurred during a sandstorm, but investigators have not determined the actual cause. The Marines were being transported to take part in an effort to provide security for Sunday's national election. Violence continues to mount across Iraq. The New York Times reports the U.S. and Iraqi forces no longer control major portions of Baghdad. One U.S. colonel in the Iraqi capital described southern Baghdad as, quote, enemy territory. Last week, Baghdad saw nearly 100 militant attacks, including 7 suicide car bombings, 37 roadside bombs, and 52 militant attacks involving rifles or grenades. In Ramadi, the Los Angeles Times reports the entire 1,000-member Iraqi police force has resigned. UPI is reporting the U.S. Air Force has begun flying combat aircraft into Iranian airspace in what could be viewed as an act of war. The report comes less than 2 weeks after investigative journalist Seymour Hersh reported that secret U.S. forces are already on the ground locating possible sites to target. According to UPI, the U.S. military is hoping to lure Tehran into turning on its air defense radars, which would allow U.S. pilots to pinpoint where the radar systems are located so they could be targeted during an invasion. UPI also reports U.S. special forces are using Iraqi Kurds near the Iranian border, as well as members of the Iranian opposition group Mujahideen-e Khalq, or MEK, to gather intelligence inside Iran. UPI reports the MEK are now launching incursions into Iran from Basra as well as Pakistan. One longtime CIA operator in the region said, quote, this looks to be turning into a pretty large-scale covert operation. UPI also reports the U.S. has begun creating a network of front companies inside Iran in order to be able to move money, weapons, and personnel around inside the country. On Capitol Hill, the Senate approved the nomination of Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State by a vote of 85-13. Next week's vote on Attorney General nominee Alberto Gonzalez is expected to be much closer. On Wednesday, he was narrowly approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee by a 10-8 vote on party lines. Another one of President Bush's new cabinet members is already making headlines. On her second day in office, Education Secretary Margaret Spellings denounced PBS for using public money to create a cartoon episode that includes lesbian characters. In one of her first acts as Education Secretary, Spellings wrote a letter to PBS complaining, quote, many parents would not want their young children exposed to the lifestyles portrayed. The show generating controversy is called Postcards from Buster. It, in a still not yet aired segment, one episode features the title character Buster traveling to Vermont. While the episode focuses focuses mostly on Vermont's farm life and maple sugar industry. The show's main character does come across characters portraying two lesbian couples living in Vermont. In her letter, Spelling suggested PBS return any federal funding used to produce the program. Later that same day, PBS announced it would not distribute the controversial episode to its 349 stations. PBS said the objections from the Education Department were not a factor in the decision. The PBS station that produced the show, WGBH in Boston, plans to air the program on March 23rd and will make the show available to other stations. Margaret Spellings comes into office replacing Education Secretary Rod Page. She's worked with Bush since the late 1980s when they were introduced by Karl Rove. Most recently, Spellings served as Bush's chief advisor on domestic issues, and she co-wrote the No Child Left Behind Act. Bush and Spellings are known to be very close. When Bush nominated her in November, he surprised many journalists when he kissed her just off the lips during the announcement ceremony. In other news from Washington, Douglas Feith has announced he's stepping down from his post as Undersecretary of Defense. He was one of the chief architects of the Iraq War and advocates of a neoconservative foreign policy. Holocaust survivors and world leaders gathered in Poland today to mark the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. Auschwitz was liberated by the Russians. More than a million people were murdered in the Auschwitz death factory. Most of the victims were Jewish. Today's gathering was attended by 2,000 Holocaust survivors and more than 40 heads of state. Vice President Dick Cheney is there, representing the Bush administration. The four British detainees released this week from Guantanamo Bay have returned home to their families. They've told their attorneys they were victims of systematic torture. Attorney Clive Stafford Smith said his client, Mozan Beg, suffered persistent beatings, death threats, and psychological torture, first at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, then at Guantanamo. Another attorney for Beg said her client has changed greatly over the last 4 years. Gareth Pierce said, quote, "I see starkly the physical difference in him. His face is the face of someone who's been through a severe ordeal. He looks like he's been to hell and back." The four men freed from Guantanamo were initially detained by British police, but released after one night. The men are now suing the U.S. for tens of millions of dollars. A major new study on climate change is warning that global warming might be twice as catastrophic as previously thought. This is according to a new study published today in the journal Nature. The study found the Earth's climate is far more sensitive to increases in man-made greenhouse gases than previously realized. Meanwhile, the World Economic Forum in Davos, British Prime Minister Tony Blair called on the U.S. to tackle global warming. And the Guardian of London reports lobby groups funded by the U.S. oil industry are targeting Britain in a bid to play down the threat of climate change and derail government action to cut greenhouse gas emissions. And attorney Lynn Stewart's defense team unsuccessfully asked the judge to declare a mistrial Wednesday after a bizarre incident outside the courthouse. According to the New York Times, six jurors were being transported home in a van Tuesday when the van driver took an unexpected turn outside the court and drove through a crowd of news camera crews and then rolled down his window to shout at a group of supporters of Stewart. The driver reportedly loudly asked, "Who's Lynn Stewart?" The jury on the Stewart case has been deliberating since January 12th, but have only met sporadically.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 37 U.S. soldiers were killed yesterday in the deadliest single day for U.S. forces since the invasion of Iraq began 2 years ago. A helicopter crash in western Iraq killed 30 Marines and one Navy sailor. Officials in Washington said that bad weather was most likely the cause. Six U.S. troops and at least 22 Iraqis were killed in separate incidents. The losses bring the total number of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq to over 1,400. As many as 100,000 Iraqis have been killed. The deaths come just days before scheduled elections in Iraq. At a news conference in Washington, President Bush called on Iraqis to, quote, defy terrorists and vote in Sunday's poll, even as violent attacks continue across the country. Just before the program, we spoke with independent journalist Dar Jamal in Baghdad. This is his report.
The election situation in Iraq is continuing to be one simply of chaos, frustration, and extreme violence as it approaches. Now, apparently, with so many of the Iraqis I'm speaking with, there's great concern of divide. While on one hand, all of the politicians are speaking of, yes, this we are being divided more between Sunni, Shia, Kurdish, and so many of the religious leaders as well, and there are some sectarian differences between Shia and Sunni arising. At the same time, so many Iraqis I speak with, in fact, the vast majority are saying, no, this is not the case. We've never had conflict between Shia and Sunni. So they are very determined not to have this divide occur from the elections. In fact, so many people, I'll ask them, are you Shia or Sunni? And they'll just answer, I am Iraqi. What difference does it make? But nevertheless, it is a situation of great chaos in this lead up to the elections. Iraq has been under martial law since November 8th, since the beginning of the siege of Fallujah. Those curfew hours are now being extended as well. Baghdad Airport is closed for the 29th and 30th, possibly longer. The national borders are closed for the 3 days around the elections, as are the satellite and cellular phone services. Civilian traffic will be very, very limited. And what the reaction this is causing on the ground, essentially, is Iraqis, it's as if people are preparing for a war here. Shops are selling out of bread and food. There's the ongoing gasoline crisis. So many families are even leaving Baghdad. In fact, there are long lines of tires stacked up at many of the checkpoints around the capital city as people are taking their families and going to stay with relatives or friends in other small communities or villages or towns outside of Baghdad. And there even have been some reports of essentially yet another refugee situation, except rather than Fallujah refugees this time, we have election refugees. Another thing causing this is that as the polling stations are being barricaded off in order to try to protect them from attacks, literally so many roads in Baghdad are literally shut down, at least 90 at last count. This is growing every single day. And then people living near these polling stations, so many of them are schools, in fact, these people are very afraid because they're saying things like, I have to leave now. I don't want my home to get mortared, or I don't want to be nearby when a giant suicide car bomb strikes this polling station. So people are very frustrated with this. Many of these people are unable to get their cars out of their house because their streets are now blocked. So it's very, very frustrating for Iraqis. It's a very dark climate of fear and anxiety, while at the same time, many people do hope that somehow through these elections there will be some more stability and security, but most feel that the elections are not going to provide this, and most feel that this violence and chaos that has become the norm in occupied Iraq will only continue to increase after the elections occur.
Independent journalist Dar Jamal speaking to us from Baghdad. This is Democracy Now! As we turn to William Arkin, military analyst, and spend the rest of the hour with him, author of a new book called Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. It identifies 3,000 once-secret codenames and details the plans and missions they stand for. Stephen Aftergood of Secrecy News has described the publication of these secrets as, quote, perhaps the most concentrated act of defiance of official secrecy policies since Howard Moreland wrote about the H-bomb secret in The Progressive in 1979. Arkin's the author of 10 other books. He's a columnist with the Los Angeles Times, military analyst, former intelligence officer. He joined us in our Firehouse studio for an extended interview. I began by asking him why he published the book.
Well, I'm in a position as a journalist and a military expert to collect a lot of this information. I guess it's been a passion of mine to follow the secret and not-so-secret meanderings of the military over the years. It seemed to me that there was an incredible explosion of secrecy after 9/11. And I guess I just felt compelled to do what it is that I was asking the government to do, which is to put it out there. I felt like if I had hoarded that information or kept it for my own use, then I'd be no better than what I'm criticizing the government for doing. And I also believe that, you know, there are secrets and there are secrets. And merely because the government stamps something classified or claims that it's secret doesn't make it so. And I wanted to challenge the trivial secrecy because it seemed to me that that was also the area where we got into the most trouble. Scandal follows secrecy like night follows day. And to me, I felt compelled both as a citizen and then as an expert to put as much out there as I could so that people would be able to understand better the kind of world that we're building after 9/11.
Explain what Polo Step is.
Polo Step is one of the many in this book. It's a compartment that was used by the Bush administration, actually was used by the Clinton administration too, to compartment secret planning in the initial war against Osama bin Laden. So in the late 1990s, when many covert operations were being mounted against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, a Polo Step was the compartment that you needed a clearance for in order to be privy to what was going on. So something might be stamped top secret Polo Step, and if you weren't read into that program and indoctrinated into Polo Step, you wouldn't be privy to the ongoing day-to-day operations. After 9/11, Polo Step was borrowed by U.S. Central Command, responsible for the Middle East, Tommy Frank's command, to be the sort of cover, if you will, for offensive planning in Iraq. And at the very time when the government was denying that we were planning to go to war with Iraq, they were building war plans, building courses of action. And in about mid-2002, I became aware of the existence of this Polo Step compartment and a Polo Step briefing about courses of action in Iraq was leaked to me. I wrote about it in the Los Angeles Times. And the reaction of the government was electric. The New York Times followed up with a front page story on July 4th. And they were very worried that all of their sort of preparations for war in Iraq were going to be compromised. It seemed to me that the far more interesting question was not what was obvious, which was that the Bush administration was planning to go to war in Iraq, but that they were methodically excluding even people internally within the Pentagon from the process of war planning by using their own internal secrecy, so that those who could have made a contribution, and what, of course, we know now is those who could have helped to sort of frame the war, even if we did go to war, to better prepare for the peace, were methodically excluded. And that so then it just seemed to me that this was the worst case of the use of secrecy, because here it was basically being used to exclude even people from the inside from participating in what arguably was the most important debate of this administration.
We're speaking to William Arkin, author of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. When we come back, he talks about losing a job over naming names. He talks about secret plans in Africa, as well as just how much control does Congress have over the Pentagon's budget. We'll talk about the black budget. Stay with us.
كم طريق كم طريق ما اخترتهوش لكن مشيته كم طريق كم طريق اخترته لكن ما مشيتوش كم طريق كم طريق ما اخترتهوش لكن مشيته كم طريق كم طريق اخترته لكن ما مشيتوش كم خيال كم خيال جوايا بالحب ابتدي.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Fifth Son, Kam Tari, is the music. We're talking to William Arkin, military analyst, who wrote the book Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. I asked him who were the critical planners in the Pentagon who were excluded in the run-up to the Iraq invasion.
Well, geez, virtually everybody. Everybody from staff officers within Central Command itself, to experts in the Pentagon and in other commands, to State Department people who were privy to and working very ferociously on Phase 4, the post-major combat operations phase of the war plan. Everybody was excluded. And Polo-Step then became a device, if you will, to limit the real war planning, the guts of it, to a very small circle. And so not only is it exclusion, but it also at the same time becomes an echo chamber, which is to say that these guys listen to themselves. They have very little outside intervention. They begin to believe their own stuff, and they're impervious to any outside views. And if you don't have access to Polo Step and you don't know what is really going on, the reality is that their argument is, well, you're not really in the loop. And if you're not in the loop in bureaucratic terms, it means that you're really not worthy to be listened to.
So maybe more importantly than who is excluded, since you're saying almost everyone, who was this core group?
I it's not particularly politically revealing who the core group is. I mean, obviously, the national security establishment at the highest level, the president and the National Security Council and the vice president and the Secretary of Defense and his deputies are that core planning element. There were people from the CIA, there were people from the State Department in that group as well. But it doesn't create an open debate. It doesn't create an open discussion. And think about it. Let's take ourselves back to 2002. It's in the newspapers every day. There's speculation about what we're doing in Iraq. We're building up our forces. It's obvious that the Bush administration is planning to go to war. And so it's the fact of war planning is not secret. The broad designs of what the war is going to be is not secret. What is really going on here is that anyone inside the system, who might have a dissenting view or who might have a different perspective is being methodically excluded. That's what's really going on, because the debate's taking place in public anyhow.
William Arkin is the author of Codenames. In your book, you reveal many of the secrets behind the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Can you talk about the role Jordan secretly played prior to the war?
Well, I think that Jordan exemplifies the problem of secrecy in the modern world. The United States and Jordan cooperate on a broad range of intelligence and military affairs. Some of that cooperation is laudable and some of it is important. And the United States, in exchange for that cooperation, accedes to making it classified. In the run-up to the Iraq War, Jordan allowed the United States to deploy special operations forces and even airplanes to air bases in western, in eastern Jordan, just on the border with western Iraq. And the provisions of that deployment was that it would have to be secret. And they used a code word, West Wing, to hide the fact that this were bases in Jordan. So they were just referred to as West Wing, as if there was a place called West Wing. And as those forces got deployed, Florida National Guardsmen got deployed from the infantry to protect the bases. Special Operations Forces went in there. British and Australian Special Operations Forces went in there. We even deployed Patriot surface-to-air missiles in downtown Amman. And yet, when it was revealed in the news media that the United States was using Jordan as a staging base to attack Iraq, the Jordanian government said, not true. We don't have any Americans here. This is absolutely untrue. And I raise in the book the question of what it does for our society, for our national security, for our spirit as Americans, to accommodate this excessive, ridiculous level of secrecy for other nations. Because the fact that there were U.S. forces in Jordan was not a secret. The Iraqis knew that there were U.S. forces in Jordan. There were obvious deployments of forces there. As I said, there were U.S. Patriot missiles in downtown Amman. But I think it sends a message. It sends a message that says states do one thing and say another.
I mean, you had King Abdullah saying that he was opposed to the war and yet privately supporting it.
Yes. And so what it does is it kind of, I think it conveys to terrorists and to those who are hostile to the United States that you can say one thing and do another. And so when the United States says, let's just say President Bush says freedom, freedom, freedom in the inaugural, what people can interpret that as meaning is, hey, you know, the United States can say freedom, freedom, freedom all it wants to, but what we see is that they're supporting repressive, non-democratic regimes. They're really interested in just killing Islamic people. They're really just interested in the oil. And though they may give a highfalutin type of imprimatur to what it is that their objectives are, in the real world, we know that these regimes are cooperating covertly with the United States, that the United States is accommodating these secrets. And I think the end result is in our overall national security is that we breed more terror, we support the wrong regimes, we don't put the same pressure on our allies and friends to democratize that we do on our enemies, and the end result is our national security is weakened. And I see this pattern in Pakistan, in Jordan, throughout the Gulf region, and in other parts of the world, where now the measure of a country's freedom, if you will, is the degree to which they are cooperating with us in the war on terrorism.
President Bush held a news conference at the White House, and he was asked if he is fighting tyranny around the world, how is he going to deal with China? How is he going to deal with Russia? How is he going to deal with Saudi Arabia? He talked about Russia. He talked about China. He just didn't comment on Saudi Arabia. Can you talk about the secret relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States?
Well, Saudi Arabia is another one of those countries, like most of the monarchies and oligarchies in the Gulf region, that has a very intimate relationship with the United States, either because it buys most of its arms from the United States because the U.S. military trains the Saudi military, or since Desert Storm, since the Gulf War in 1990-1991, the United States has consistently deployed forces on Saudi soil. Of course, consistently deployed forces, even though they are not officially there and it is officially classified. I mean, the United States flew B-52 bombers from Jeddah during the Gulf War, and it's still a secret. Secret from whom? You can't miss a B-52 bomber taking off from an air base. The Iraqis knew that they were there. Everybody knew that they were there. Just the American people aren't supposed to know that they were there. And Saudi Arabia, like most countries, we wrangle and wrangle with them behind the scenes to try to get them to be more cooperative in dealing with the Al-Qaeda that's in their midst, in dealing with terrorism, in liberalizing their society, etc. But yet at the same time, the price we pay when the Saudis don't move, when the Saudis don't cooperate with the United States, when the Saudis don't do what is necessary, is that we keep our mouths shut because they're paying us something, which is they're providing access for our military in that part of the world.
Your book is called Code Names, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. William Markin, can you talk about some of those code names for operations around Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think that to me, in Saudi Arabia particularly, what I like is I like the set of military exercises which sort of serve as cover for cooperative counterterrorism operations. So they're called military exercises. And they all have very intricate names. And those names then kind of serve as cover. So an exercise might come up at some point in time. And it might be in Central Command, most of the words are of the IN series. The military is very organized. So all these code names are sort of in a very organized way. So Inspired, Intrepid, those are the code names that each relate to a different country. So you might see a press release, or you might see something in a military newsletter or a newspaper that says the United States is deploying forces for Inspired Venture 04. Yet, in reality, what Inspired Venture 04 is a joint counterterrorism operation or some joint cooperative operation between the United States and Saudi Arabia. In fact, again, for Operation Iraqi Freedom, the war in Iraq, the United States deployed special operations forces in northern Saudi Arabia, NRR. They deployed reconnaissance aircraft in Tobruk. The United States deployed forces in Saudi Arabia. In fact, it ran the air war from Riyadh. Yet, officially, Saudi Arabia was merely involved in defending its own country and was not involved in this war.
It's very hard for people in the U.S. to get this information. What kind of information gap is there between people in the rest of the world and people in the United States, supposedly, which has the freest press?
Well, I think that, the United States ipso facto has the freest press. I've written this book, so it shows it. I think that they are not going to get the information because the complexity and the Byzantine nature of the military and the U.S. national security establishment is such that it takes an expert to decipher it. We've seen that in all of the recent stories about secret Pentagon units and secret Pentagon involvement in the inaugural, et cetera. I mean, these are incredibly complex things that I've been doing this for many, many years and still have a hard time figuring out A from B and B from C. So I'm not surprised that it doesn't proliferate down until somebody writes about it first here. It has to mostly originate in the U.S. or the British press or sometimes in some other foreign press. But most of the time, the truth of the matter is that they will write about it once it's written about here. However, I'm not expecting that I'm going to see many articles in the Saudi or Jordanian press about the covert U.S. military relationship with those countries.
You've been hit hard when you talk about issues like this. Can you talk about losing a job over naming names?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. I think one of the first jobs I had was working for a little nonprofit in Washington, D.C. called the Center for Defense Information. This was in the early 80s. And I worked on an article relating to where all the nuclear weapons were in Germany, U.S. nuclear weapons. And I had pieced it together by looking at telephone books and various military manuals, and promptly was fired from my job. Big deal. I mean, I can't work somewhere where that's not going to support the notion of openness. As I say in the introduction to this book, hey, you either believe in democracy or you don't. You either believe in openness or you don't. I mean, there's no way I'm going to convince you of it if you don't believe in it. So I've been doing this now for almost 30 years. I wrote a book in the 1980s that revealed where all the nuclear weapons were around the world. The Reagan administration was not very happy about it and came down on me pretty hard. They threatened to throw me in jail. And it took many months of negotiations with the Reagan administration to convince them that I had not used any access to classified information in order to compile that book. That was the key that they would have used as the excuse to put me in jail. So it took many, many months to do that. It was quite a hairy time.
Can you talk about the stands and code names, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan?
Well, the Uzbek case, of course, was the most important during the 1990s. This is where most of the CIA special operations were run out of in terms of the early Osama bin Laden years, the Clinton administration's war against Osama bin Laden. Uzbekistan was generally very cooperative. It also served as the hub for most of the Northern Alliance's activities in Afghanistan. As we built up our capacity in Uzbekistan, also at the same time, we built up a stockpile of secrets that sort of covered it. And not just Uzbekistan, but also Pakistan, to some degree, Tajikistan. Turkmenistan was more hostile to the United States, and we didn't have as much access. But in each case, we would take up occupation of a former Soviet air base or some other former Soviet military facility, build up a small enclave of American activity, either CIA, special operations of the military, or even contractors. We started to fly the Predator drones out of Uzbekistan and Pakistan, doing surveillance of Afghanistan in September 2000. And so by the time 9/11 came around, the United States already had a small web of covert relations with many nations on the periphery of Afghanistan. And that certainly facilitated the quicker movement of U.S. forces to the region. We were able to then take up a rather major presence at Jacobabad, Shamsi Air Base in western Pakistan, where most of the special operations that were mounted in Afghanistan were staged out of. But also the United States utilized quiet secret bases in Oman, in Kuwait, in the United Arab Emirates, in Bahrain. And so really rather quickly, the forces were able to be mobilized to ring around Afghanistan, and it's one of the reasons why you were able to see such a high level of activity so very quickly with not very much preparation.
William Arkin is our guest. His book is Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World, Africa. Can you talk about relationship with different countries?
Well, I would have said to you prior to the current insurgency in Iraq that Africa was going to be the next front in the war on terrorism. All of the signs pointed to a buildup of U.S. military and CIA capacity, particularly in the Horn of Africa, staging mostly out of Djibouti and covering the countries mostly of Sudan, Somalia, to some degree western Kenya, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. But I think as the military has become more and more bogged down in the quagmire in Iraq, it has sort of backed off of its grandiose plans for the Horn. There are some other military activities in the heart of Africa. We have done a lot of training and a lot of deployments in Mauritania, particularly to some degree in southern Morocco. There's been some degree of cooperation with the French in Chad, and there have been some deployments in Central Africa as well. But I think this notion that the military was going to open up a new front in the war on terrorism kind of evaporated as they began to have to put all of their resources into Iraq. And in some ways, it is a very practical manifestation of an argument that was made against the war in Iraq, which is that people said this was going to dilute the effort in the war on terrorism. And in fact, it has. It really has. I mean, and I say this as somebody who sort of keeps an eye on all of those little places and tries to see where the ebb and flow of emphasis and effort is. So for Americans who even might not have opposed the war in Iraq for reasons relating to the evidence, they can certainly understand today that what it has done is it has made the other efforts in the war on terrorism much more difficult.
Some code names in Africa?
Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, headquartered in Djibouti, has a whole set of interesting code names, many of which I have been unable to decipher. So I can't associate the words with the countries yet. I'm still trying to figure it out. But I've seen an interesting growth in the code names associated with, particularly with the Algeria, Mauritania, the southern part of Algeria, Mauritania, where it looks to me like there's an ongoing operation. But I would certainly like to know more.
Military analyst William Mark in his book is Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. When we come back, we'll find out about Operation Druid Leader. Stay with us. Sister Savior by The Rapture, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, broadcasting in over 300 radio and TV stations, and video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to military analyst William Arkin, author of the book Codenames, I asked him what the operations Druid Leader, Elephant Grass, and Surf Fisher were. What do they mean?
Well, during the Iran-Iraq War, the United States in its strategic view at the time, felt that it was really necessary to support the Iraqi government because, God forbid, the Iranians should win. Fundamental Shia would take over the rest of the world, threaten our friends in the Gulf oil region, and it would be curtains for U.S. national security. And in that environment, the United States mounted a series of covert operations to provide intelligence information to Saddam Hussein. I met the aide to Saddam Hussein, who was the interlocutor between the U.S. and Iraq in 1993. And I remember at one time we were in a discussion in a cafe about U.S. relations with Iraq and the future. And he got very angry and said, you know, don't tell me about what states do. I was the guy who was the liaison with the U.S. government during the Iran-Iraq war. And you were saying one thing and doing another at the time. It was when a light bulb went on above my head that said, wow, in the real world, you know, what the Saddam Hussein government perceives is that the United States is going to do whatever the United States feels like it's going to do to protect its own interests. And what it does publicly is really separate from what it does privately, because here they were getting satellite photographs, they were getting briefings on the nature of the Iranian forces, and the United States was looking the other way as Iraq was using chemical weapons both against the Kurds in the north and against the Iranians in the south. They were hesitant to criticize the Iraqi government at a time when the Iraqis were getting support from us, but also at the same time the Iraqis were opening up the coffers and buying increasing U.S. products, particularly rice from the United States, as payment for this provision of intelligence information, and that's the whole Iraqgate scandal that the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, was bending over backwards to cooperate with the Iraqis to win the Iran-Iraq war, while at the same time profiting by the Iraqis giving preferential contracts to the U.S. Companies.
So Saddam Hussein was Druid Leader?
It's unclear what each of those code names were, but we know that what happens with code names is they get changed a lot. These could all be the same program, who knows? But I know that they're all associated with the top secret program of cooperating with Iraq during this period from the mid-1980s all the way almost up to the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait.
William Arkin, let's step back for a minute to the Pentagon's so-called black budget. Mm-hmm. How much of it is secret? How much of it is their congressional overview?
Well, You know, when you look at a guidebook of 3,000 plus code names, 600 of which have never been in the public domain before, which means they're not in the budget, they're not in newspaper articles, they've never been published. You know, one of the things that you got to conclude from that is, how can anybody in Congress monitor and oversee all of this activity? I mean, I've spent years on this and have a very a tentative grasp upon all of these secrets. So I know that there is a statutory requirement for the Pentagon to report the existence of special access programs to the Congress on an annual basis. But most people would be surprised to know that that's done in the form of literally a report. A list of names gets sent forward with a one or two line description of what the program is. And there are literally a half dozen people within the entire U.S. Congress who have a high enough clearance to read that report. So when you're talking about hundreds of programs, and then you're talking about layers of different types of special access programs, I think we can all agree they don't get very effective oversight. So you have the double problem of the compartmentalization itself used as a way of avoiding oversight within the Defense Department and within the government. Lawyers or others don't have access to all of these programs. And then you have Congress, which is only sort of perfunctorily made aware of the existence of these programs as well. So I would conclude, as we've watched again and again and again during the Abu Ghraib scandal or during the whole debate over the handling of prisoners in Guantanamo, that Congress is not effectively monitoring what's going on. They have a tentative grasp upon the totality of U.S. military and intelligence activities around the world. And one of the devices that's used to ensure that the Congress isn't able to monitor it is this alphabet soup of code names, which is basically employed to keep it secret.
How would you assess the war in Iraq right now?
It seems to me that we are going to be hearing the phrase withdraw with honor at some point in the next 2 years. Though the U.S. military is sort of marching in lockstep, at least the leadership saying we're going to be there for another 1 or 2 years, and they're probably holding their breath hoping that it ain't any longer than that. The truth of the matter is that I think there's been a sea change inside the American military in the last year, where their enthusiasm for the process of democratization and their mission in Iraq has really evaporated. And since I'm close to the military and follow the military, when I see something like that happen, I really recognize that the Bush administration is operating on an ideological platform only, that it even has tentative support from its own military leadership.
Well, what about this, the level of resistance in the military? I mean, we don't hear very much about I think even the Pentagon's admitting something like 5,500 people who are resisting going to Iraq. You've got, with Alberto Gonzalez, more than the Democrats at the beginning, retired admirals and generals who are speaking out against him for attorney general. How significant is this?
Well, I think it is significant. It's a sad day for America when in October and November before an election, you have more retired generals and admirals calling for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq than you have Democratic candidates. And I think that though we tend to use those generals and admirals sometimes as a kind of, on our side, the truth of the matter is that there's a tremendous amount of discomfort, as there has been from day one, with the ideology of the Bush administration. The professional military has been shunted aside and has been ignored, and their advice has been not taken seriously. Resistance is a funny word because it comes back to sort of the Vietnam era and a draft in which you had a lot of normal people being dragooned into the military and were true resistors. You know, today in the environment of a volunteer force, even in the National Guard and the reserves, people just generally tend to go into the military because it's their choice. And we pay them fairly good wages these days. A lot of that increase in defense spending is for enlistment and reenlistment bonuses that are ranging in the tens of thousands of dollars these days. you know, thank God we have the National Guard to some degree in the reserves, because at least those are people who are not dependent upon the military and are willing to speak out. But by and large, you know, I would say to you that Americans should pay much more attention to the fact that there are high-ranking officials, knowledgeable people, who formerly were high-level commanders in the military, who are deeply concerned about not just Iraq, but the way in which we are pursuing the war on terrorism, and this notion that we're going to win the war on terrorism by killing terrorists one at a time, Wild West style. To me, that's a far more serious indictment of the lack of support and lack of thought that the Bush administration has put into all of this, because as somebody who's been in the military and as somebody who has done this for 30 years, I'd say to you, the complaints that I hear from soldiers today are not much different than complaints that I've heard from soldiers for 30 years and before. They're always going to complain. That's one of the wonderful things about soldiers. But when you have so many retired ambassadors, retired generals and admirals and others who are themselves speaking out in an environment right now in which people are fearful of speaking out, that's a really significant sea change. And though those people were not willing to speak out before the Iraq war, unfortunately, you know, I really think we've seen a significant change in the past year since Fallujah, April 04, where they have said this is going nowhere and the blood of Americans that is being spilled is really not going to achieve the goals that we think they're going to achieve.
Bill Arkin, how much does it cost to keep these secrets secret? Now we have studies that are saying that the secrecy is actually hurting Homeland Security because states and local municipalities can't get information from the federal government.
Well, to administer the federal security system is $7.5 billion a year. We're tending also to classify more and more information in a trivial way. The Department of Homeland Security is inventing new classifications, sensitive but unclassified, SBU, law enforcement sensitive, and other things like that. And they're trying to dragoon local law enforcement agencies into the security system so that they can exchange information, which increasingly then makes them just cogs in a bigger national security picture. The costs are significant. Even by the Bush administration's own accounting, the costs are significant. But I think the costs to our nation, the costs to the American spirit, the cost to our foreign policy, the cost to international security is really much greater. And I'm hoping that my book in some way serves as an anchor for a lively debate, a more informed debate, and hopefully more candidness in the future.
There's a piece in the Washington Times by Tony Blankley, you know, Newt Gingrich's man when he was Speaker of the House. It's in the Washington Times. Its headline is Espionage by Any Other Name, and it's about Seymour Hersh, and it's about the piece he wrote exposing U.S. operations in Iran and suggesting that his revealing this, that perhaps he is engaged in espionage. And he points out, when you look at the U.S. code, that people involved in espionage, it's a crime punishable by death or by imprisonment for any term of years or for life.
I certainly hope that he writes the same op-ed about my book so I can sell a few more books. I don't really take it very seriously. I've heard the arguments for 20-something years in terms of my writings. The truth of the matter is, if the government really felt that there was something that was being compromised that somehow infringed upon U.S. national security, they would take action. So this is polemical. The reality is that most of these secrets are trivial, mundane, unimportant, and the ones that are truly important are ones that the government feels compelled to protect anyhow, because to admit that they are in fact legitimate secrets is to open themselves up to further oversight.
And the Pentagon's battle with the CIA, how does it play in here? Rumsfeld in the ascendancy.
Well, now, I think one of the things we've certainly seen since 9/11 is an explosion of new commands, new units, new operations on the part of the Pentagon. You know, to some degree, if you were a supporter of the war on terrorism, which I'm not particularly, you would either say, well, we should give Rumsfeld a medal because he has worked, you know, very strongly to create ad hoc units when the bureaucracy has failed to respond, And so you would say to yourself, well, that's great. You know, Rumsfeld's a man of action, and that's what we want. On the other hand, you know, he cuts corners and he ignores the law when it proves necessary. And since we are a society of laws and we're trying to impose a society of laws, it's important that we abide by them. So I think that we should not get bogged down in that typical Washington debate of bureaucracy versus bureaucracy, because it misses the big picture. The issue here is not CIA versus Pentagon. I don't support either agency, so I really couldn't care less which one wins the bureaucratic battle. The real story here is, what is our strategy in fighting the war on terrorism? How are we building up our capacity to do so? And is it the right strategy to pursue? If the Pentagon is doing it, I have some problems. If the CIA is doing it, I have some problems. But it's typical Washington that what they want to talk about is how the organizational chart is organized, and fight about whether the block should be here or there rather than fight about the fundamental question of what the strategy is.
Would you say the president is leading the most secret administration in the history of this country?
It appears to me at this point that the answer is yes, that having lived through the Reagan administration and watched the rise of the new Cold War during the 1980s, I would say that though I saw a significant shift in secrecy in the early 90s, the truth of the matter is that what we had was a real regeneration of the entire world of secret operations and covert operations, starting in the late Clinton administration and then accelerated during 9/11.
I want to end here at home. People think about operations abroad, code names abroad. The New York Times on Sunday, a headline, Commandos See Duty on U.S. Soil in New Role in Terrorism Fight, where they quote you revealing one of the codenamed operations. What is happening here at home?
Well, I think that the Bush administration, mesmerized by the threat of weapons of mass destruction, their nightmare, is again creating a whole host of secret operations and contingency plans for how the military would be used to protect the presidency and perhaps even take special powers. Were there to be a weapons of mass destruction incident in Washington or in the United States, we are witnessing a slow slide of the military increasingly in domestic affairs in this country, and that is something that should be very worrisome to every American.
Explain the whole operation.
Oh, it's the growth of domestic commands. The increasingly intimate relationship between the military and local law enforcement agencies, the use of military assets in surveillance and intelligence in the U.S. It's a bigger story and probably one worthy of another discussion sometime in the future.
What is Power Geyser?
Power Geyser is the top secret contingency plan for the use of Delta Force in an emergency to protect the presidency. And we don't really know what those authorities would be, but they're not in the law.
Military analyst William Arkin, author of Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operations in the 9/11 World. And that does it for today's program. Our website is democracynow.org. I'll be in Dublin and Kildare, Ireland on Saturday. Look forward to seeing people there. And London School of Economics on Sunday at 2. Go to our website for the latest in our travels. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Special thanks to Adam Howard and Angela Alston, to Eric Osohu, John Randolph, and Orlando Richards. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.